Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Jeremy Burgess of Rough Riders.
Jeremy Burgess, what's up, man?
Hey, not too much, Ben. How you doing?
Doing great. So you and I have seen Barry Jenkins' new movie, Moonlight, which is one of the most highly acclaimed movies of 2016. I saw it this past weekend. You had seen it before then, and you just caught it a second time. So you've seen this movie twice now. And before we get right into it, I want to point out that a lot of the praise for this movie has been downright hyperbolic in some senses. Mm-hmm. And that's at least my perception of it going into it. Before I saw it, I thought, wow, like, people really love this movie. It seems really unique based on very little that I knew about it. So I tried to know as little as possible going in, and I saw it. And so now I kind of know what people are going for. But you were, I counted you among those people who are just heaping enormous praise on it. In a couple of words you used after you saw it a second time, I believe you tweeted, "I saw Moonlight again, and it basically confirmed what I said before. This movie is perfect and necessary," were the words that you used. And if you could just start there, Jeremy, as we talk about this now that we've both seen it, what do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, for one, I think from a filmmaking standpoint, I don't think that there's anything – I wouldn't say that it's like the greatest movie of all time, but I don't think Jenkins failed any tests on the filmmaker checklist. You've got cinematography, direction, performances, music, just everything to me might not have been an A-plus exactly, but it was a high mark across the board. And then the word necessary comes to mind. You know, I'll try not to get too political, but it feels, I saw it first a month ago at the New Orleans Film Festival, and then I saw it this weekend. So once before the election, once after the election. And that informed my second viewing a little bit, but it's the kind of story that we don't hear as much as we should these days. It's getting better, I think. Hollywood's getting better at representing people of color or the LGBTQ community, but not always do those overlap. And so I thought Moonlight handled this subject matter in just an incredibly nuanced and subtle way to show us it's almost like a still life in a way. There's no real movie moments, if you know what I mean. Nothing that's exaggerated or over the top. It all feels and I can't say from my perspective that it feels accurate necessarily, because I don't come from that background of that race or orientation or social class, but it just rang true for me across the board from what I have observed.
Absolutely. I just sticking with, again, sort of like the sociological, political ramifications and sort of themes that it goes for, you're right. Like, we don't see enough stories like this told on the big screen.
Yeah.
And there are not enough opportunities. And we don't see enough stories about black people, black children, black mm-hmm. black individuals. We don't see enough films about poor black people. And we don't see hardly any films about poor black people who also happen to be gay and about those people in the LGBT community, like you mentioned. So in that regard, this movie is so deeply layered and so unique, just in terms of it's a story that hardly ever gets told. And so the fact that it's in the hands of a director like Barry Jenkins, whose work I was completely unfamiliar with going into it. This is my first exposure to him, but I'm pretty clear at this point that this guy is a seriously talented filmmaker who has not only deep talent, but deep care and concern for storytelling and for character. Quite honestly, you mentioned that it doesn't have any big movie moments. 100% agree with you right there. But the only thing that I will say is this movie is just like visually like resplendent at times. Like it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
It's gorgeously shot. The camera moves.
From the very first scene, we have that long take.
Yeah.
That kind of sets the stage there.
Yeah, there are several long takes, and there are moments in this movie that are shot in a way to me that are similar to thrillers and movies that, involves suspenseful moments, especially during sort of this sort of like climactic moment between the main character during the third act and his old friend. And we'll get more specific about the characters and the actors.
Sure.
But there's a moment where like the Steadicam follows the main character into this diner, and the move and once he's in there, it's so quiet, it's so steady, and you're hanging on to every single little moment as if something huge and enormous is going to happen. In many ways, something huge and enormous does happen, but it happens in the most unexpectedly quiet way. Like, it's so matter of fact, and how simple it is in terms of like the human condition and the human experience, and how this should be more simple than it is. But there are moments that define these characters, these human beings, in the way that they shoot them, like I mentioned before, in ways that you would see in thrillers and in more in traditionally intense moments. To me, that's what sort of sets this apart.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you mention a thriller comparison, because it is a very quiet, subtle movie. I guess it simmers more than you would say like it has big bangs or anything like that. But it's still the kind of thing where I was on the edge of my seat just because of the events that were unfolding. You know, there were no explosions or damsels in distress or anything like that, but I was just 100% invested in the outcome of every exchange or conversation. And I wanted to know, I was, you know, 100% invested in those characters as well, and wanted to see how they act and how they respond to certain prompts, I guess.
Yeah, and in terms of just somebody finding out who they are, what their identity is, coming to grips with who they've become and the way that they've lived their life and how everything has informed them up to that point, when I guess Barry Jenkins and everybody, you know, working with him, when they treat subject matter like that as seriously as you see in traditional drama and even character studies, it's amazing how exciting that is. Like you said, you're on the edge of the seat just to see how this person sort of comes to grips with his new reality, right? And how he sort of figures out how he'll soon express himself for maybe the rest of his life as he has this very basic human interaction that will define him forever. And that, to me, is what made this such a unique experience, because, again, it's like you don't really think about, you know, just how powerful these very simple human moments are.
Yeah, and that's the whole movie, is just a collection of moments. We, you know, we have the three-act structure where there's a different age for our main character, Chiron, and the most powerful moments are often just conversations where, whether that's Chiron age, I guess he was about 8 or 9, asking what certain words mean, or if it was adult Chiron reconnecting with an old friend that altered the course of his life forever. And we do have some moments like the pinnacle moment of Act Two. Are we getting into spoilers here, by the way?
I think it's okay to get into spoilers.
Sure. So, yeah, I guess the most exciting dramatic moment is when Chiron picks up that chair and just swings at the school bully. And, you know, as much as that was an invigorating experience too, just these conversations where they're not saying more than 4 or 5 words at a time. You know, even Kevin, Chiron's counterpart, I guess you would say, in this each stage of this drama, he mentions that he doesn't talk much, and we get that throughout the story, is that our main character often doesn't know how to express himself. He's a very quiet person.
Yeah, another unique quality of this movie, that our hero, our protagonist, is an introvert, and like you said, he has no idea what to say. He has no idea really who he is at this point, because he lives in a community that sort of challenges that notion his perspective, his point of view, and again his identity. But before we get any more specific, Jeremy, if you will, just sort of quickly lay out what this movie's about, sort of what this story is.
Sure. So I'll do a little bit of deconstructing here. Someone asked a friend of mine, "Hey, is this movie like the black version of Boyhood?" And I could see how you would say that from the outside, just from seeing the trailer. You've got well, not obviously the same character in each stage of life, but you're focusing on this young man named Chiron, who is black, who ends up realizing at a certain point that he is gay also. And he comes from the Liberty City community in Miami, which I don't know too much about Liberty City, but from what we're shown, is a fairly lower class community. And his mother is also a drug addict. And we find out soon enough that she's getting her drug from this drug dealer, Juan, who takes in Chiron and sort of becomes a father figure that he never had. So we see all of this in the first act when we're focused on Chiron, who's about age 8 or 9. And then we get to see him, I guess he's about 17, like a junior or senior in high school. You immediately notice that his voice has changed. So we know that he's grown a good bit in just a, 7 or 8 year span. And then we see his school interactions with his friends or lack thereof. And then once that segment is done, we get Chiron, I guess he's about age 30, 32, something around there, where he has, we hear that he went to juvenile detention center, and perhaps maybe something after that, some sort of prison. But he is now, as he says, trapping. He's a drug dealer in Atlanta, Georgia, and that is him kind of growing up in the footsteps of the main influence of his youth, Juan.
Yeah, I mean, that basically sets it all up, and so much happens to this character in between that, again, it's really about the simple things that, again, define you for the rest of your life and inform how you're going to live your life and who you're going to be, and the difficulty for many people in, again, coming to grips with that, accepting that their community, their family, their friends, accepting that those qualities about them. And that is why this movie, like you said, is so necessary, I think. And again, yeah, like, you can look at it as being released, made in at this point, a post-Obama America, and now a Trump America, and there are different ways that you can certainly look at it in terms of its relevance and how necessary it is for everybody to see it, from all sorts of kinds of people from different kinds of backgrounds, to sort of understand different backgrounds and different perspectives and people, but really, more specifically, just this one person in this character.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is just a very singular experience for this one individual, but, you know, it may apply to hundreds or thousands or even millions of people who might be able to identify with this character's struggle and experience. But, yeah, for me, I mean, I just love how personal and specific it is to this character. It's a fascinating character, one that you root for, one that you feel sorry for. I mean, for me especially, like, it was hardest to watch when he was – I mean, it's hard to watch for all with all three stages.
It breaks your heart, yeah.
Yeah,
constantly
for the child,
breaks your heart.
You know, like, especially when he's a child and you're watching him go through this and just not understand himself, not being able to express himself hardly to anybody. And you've already referenced it before that there's a moment during the first act where Juan and his girlfriend Teresa are talking to the boy at a table. And you mentioned before he's asking what certain words mean. And he mentions a word that denigrates homosexuals. And he basically comes close to having the quote-unquote talk in terms of trying to understand his sexuality and if that's something that if it's the right time to do that. And I just thought that the grace with which the characters in the scene use to help the boy understand himself and understand his situation, I thought was amazing. And it's a unique scene, the type of scene that you don't see very often, and you wonder how different people handle situations like that. And to me, that was probably the most powerful and rawest scene of the movie.
Sure, yeah. Grace is a good word for it. That scene in particular, there's something that I caught the second time that didn't quite stick the first time. When young Chiron brings up that word that we won't repeat, Juan explains what it means, and then he says, unless, and he looks at Teresa, and she kind of shakes her head.
Yep.
So there's a lot left unsaid in that conversation, too.
Right.
You know, like, what a boy should or shouldn't hear at that age. just really remarkably nuanced in how they handled that exchange, I think. But for me, I think I failed to mention in giving the synopsis that Chiron's friend Kevin is really the through line in each of these three segments. And I think in that way, a few of the lines that Kevin says at each age, or a few of the exchanges that Chiron has with each with Kevin at each stage, those are really what inform us to the heart of the film. You've got Chiron as a young boy when they're out there playing football. He doesn't really know what to do. He looks kind of lost and like he feels like he doesn't belong. Kevin tells him, "You got to show him you ain't soft." And then in Act Two, we see Chiron literally pick up a chair and start swinging at the school bully to show him that he ain't soft. And then in the third act, he's just an incredibly muscular, intimidating figure as a drug dealer as well. We see one great scene where he kind of messes with the mind of one of his employees, which is a pretty great exchange to see where he's at that point. But there's another line to me that really, I think, is the most important line of the film, is when we have that seminal moment between Kevin and Chiron on the beach. And Kevin's kind of hinting at, you know, this unsaid chemistry between them. And Chiron tells him, "I want to do a lot of things that don't make sense." And so we see that this young man at 16 or 17 years old has been told that his way of life doesn't make sense. And for once in his life, it's starting to make sense with that person. And so then, yeah, we learn in the third act that that was the first time anyone had ever touched him. It's what he says to Kevin, and then no one's touched him since. And so that breaks your heart all over again, that that one moment that he had in his 30, 32 years of life was the only moment where he was really comfortable with who he was.
Yeah, and if it doesn't matter what your orientation is, if you don't identify with that moment, you're kind of soulless,
right?
You know, like
check your pulse.
It's such a powerful moment, like you said, because I mean, as quiet as the character is, and as reserved as he is, as soon as he says that, and you see his face, you just understand him, and you understand sort of like the anguish that he's clearly been going through for part of, what,
right,
35 years maybe of his life, and the fact that he finally has this person who meant so much to him back in his life, and he has a moment where he can confide that. It's just an enormous, moment that it's weirdly crowd-pleasing in the fact that he's able to get that out of his system. But, yeah, I mean, the moments that you mentioned are great, and but, again, like, going back to that climactic scene between Chiron and Kevin in the diner, it's just an amazingly staged and acted scene that the movie has just been building towards the whole time, and sort of the aftermath of even that, when the two can sort of interact in intimate quarters where they're allowed to sort of be themselves behind closed doors, even in 2016, you know, it's just amazing to put that in perspective. But you know, for somebody to go there basically their entire life up to that point without knowing sort of what to do generally as a person, again, how to express themselves at some point in their lives, and more often than not, they just need people to tell them if they're conflicted, if they're struggling internally, they need somebody in their life to tell them that it's okay for you to act this way or be this way. And it largely depends on your household and your community, each of which really challenged him growing up and didn't really let him express himself that way and be the person that he knew that he actually was, but was so scared of admitting that he was, to even the closest people in his life, including his mom, who rejected that aspect of his life. And she obviously, played by Naomi Harris here, again, you mentioned she was a drug addict, and she's just sort of absent at times. And he has these sort of surrogate parents in Juan and Teresa, but they're not really his parents. And even they are rejected by the Naomi Harris character, creating another conflict that he sort of has to face down as he tries to, you know, make it through this journey. So, I mean, it's just so complex, and it's such an amazingly drawn very specifically drawn character that I think will speak to a lot of people if they just give this movie a chance.
Oh, for sure. It's, yeah, like you said, and that's why I use the term necessary, is because, you know, like, I don't want to criticize how anybody votes, but we're seeing nowadays that this type of person, the Chirones of the world, are the type of stories that we don't quite understand. And maybe it's going too far to say that anyone doesn't empathize with his situation or totally ignores his situation, but I don't think that many of us understand it. And even I learned a lot from this film just by watching this one character's story. And that's why I think I had a line in my Letterboxd review the first time around where I said, this may not win any Oscars, but you'll see it. Your kids will see it in their schools in a generation from now. And then I think 2 weeks after that, I saw that the University of Alabama was doing like a school-sponsored viewing of it, and I thought that was fantastic that they were doing that. So, yeah, I'm glad that it's being seen as this sort of necessary piece of art that we can apply to our current time.
Really unique movie, and I think it's interesting you mentioned Boyhood, which I think is a fine comparison. The movie that I thought about that I think is kind of a kindred spirit to this movie just in terms of tone and scope, I don't know if you've seen The Place Beyond the Pines, that movie.
I have, yes.
That is the movie that I thought about when I was watching this, especially just in terms of the three-act structure. The three-act structure and just, again, sort of the scope of, you know, it's a movie that, The Place Beyond the Pines is an imperfect movie, but it really swings for the fences just in terms of telling this sort of family epic and this character epic. And I, you know, in retrospect, I really liked the movie and what the director was going for. And it was very personal, silly at times. I don't think this movie is quite silly or as melodramatic as that, but they definitely reminded me of each other. But just in terms of the technical qualities of this movie, you mentioned it all before, the cinematography is gorgeous. The music used, both the original score and the pieces that they picked to go along with it, really fantastic choices, pop songs even at times, unexpected choices made by Jenkins there. And, I mean, it has a really unique look. This movie, like you said, it kind of checks all the boxes. It has a lot going for it. And as just film fans and fans of directors, it excites me that, you know, there's a new name and face in Barry Jenkins to keep an eye on moving forward.
Sure, sure. And just to kind of change gears, I guess, you mentioned the music. I did want to kind of share some thoughts on that, because I think the second time around, that's what stood out to me even more, the score as well as the musical choices. In particular, there are two songs, one being Cell Therapy by Goody Mob. That's the first song we hear at the beginning of Act 3. And just because I'm familiar with that song and love that song, as soon as we hear that at the beginning of Act 3, I thought, oh, he's in Atlanta now. And it turns out that was like a little audio clue that we've shifted from Miami to Atlanta. But also, that's a complex song, and it's about Goody Mob. They're using it as a message of sorts, a warning to younger people in their community about violence and drugs and mental health. And yeah, if you just go back and listen to that song, I think there's a lot going on and a pretty clear reason why Jenkins chose that for that moment, aside from the fact that it's just a great song. But then I think another more interesting choice that we hear about part of the way into the third act is a song called Classic Man by Jidenna. And at first, when I watched it the first time, I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting that they would use a current song. I guess they're letting us know that it's present day. But also, it's the screwed and chopped version of Classic Man. And if anyone's unfamiliar, that's just a style of hip-hop from Houston a couple decades ago where the beats per minute are slowed down and some of the tracks, the vocal tracks, are layered over each other. So it creates this whole different sound. And I think maybe that's Jenkins' way of letting us know that this film as a whole is like a screwed and chopped version of what it means to be a classic man. And we see that most fully, I think, in adult Chiron, who, you know, we had that line from Kevin, "It's not what I expected. Maybe this is not where we saw Chiron being when he was an adult." But also, like, as far as the Screwed and Chopped goes, I listened to the Film Spotting interview with Barry Jenkins, and they mentioned that the score itself is actually Screwed and Chopped, which I didn't pick up on the first time. But knowing that and watching it with that in mind in the second viewing, it's clear. The pianos, the strings, I think there might be an oboe in there. But, yeah, the composer takes all those sounds, slows them down. So it's this clear effect of, like, it's like a Screwed and Chopped film in that way. And obviously, like, visually, that wouldn't apply. But I thought that was a really interesting technique.
Absolutely. Again, it's doing a lot of different things that you don't typically see, even in American independent films. So it's just really nice to see sort of a fresh perspective and a fresh filmmaking voice that has an extremely bright future. But we should probably focus on the present in terms of this movie that he has made that is a pretty significant contribution. And like you said, it is extremely relevant. And you know, I haven't seen the movie Loving yet, the Jeff Nichols movie that is due in more theaters later this year. Have you seen that yet, by the way?
I haven't seen Loving, but I saw today that it arrives in Birmingham tomorrow.
Oh, perfect.
As of the time that we're recording this. But
yeah, and
hopefully when you're listening, I've seen it already. And it's, you know, Jeff Nichols is, I think, pretty clearly my top director of this decade. I think his body of work this decade is heads and tails equal to or slightly greater than just about anybody.
Right, and you
so
know,
I'm super excited for this one.
I definitely have high expectations for Loving, but the reason I bring it up is because if you watch a movie, a trailer for a movie like Loving, or if you just read like the log line and the plot, the plot summary of it, it's something that should just at this point kind of infuriate you. You know, as you're watching
that, we need movies like that. Today.
Well, that we need movies like it, but it's that something so simple was just rejected and misunderstood.
Yeah.
And it was a long time ago, but really not that long ago.
Not that long.
About
no.
it. Yeah, and but then you see that this movie is being made, and I hear a lot. Some of the feedback from it is, well, it's just very simple, right? Or like, that's it? And it's like, yeah, that's kind of the point. You know, that's why this movie
right.
was made, because that's it. Like, back in the 1950s, like, we were at that point, and you think something so simple now, for whatever reason, in 2016, 50 years, 60 years later, it's still relevant. And it's unfortunate that we're still at that point, but I think the same kind of goes for Moonlight, where we're still at a point, even today, in present day, which, you know, it feels modern enough, but in many ways it doesn't. But we're still at a point now where a story seemingly as simple as Moonlight is still so pertinent to people who are struggling with the same problem that the main character is. And it's amazing that it's that hard for people and individuals out there. But it is. And this movie is just, thankfully, another voice out there saying, it's okay. And this is a movie that expresses that concern and that feeling, and hopefully it'll reach people who are sort of going through the same journey that the main character is. And while it may not cause them to maybe immediately speak up, it'll give them a little more insight and give them a little more courage moving forward. And if it accomplishes that, then it's done something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, even though I haven't seen it yet, we haven't seen it yet, I think the Loving comparison is being made by some folks out there because of the approach to its subject matter, the tone, I guess, where it's not over the top. And we've seen that story done a lot of times in that over the top manner. Something like The Help comes to mind. And it just, for whatever reason, despite good intentions, just doesn't connect always. And, you know, The Help reached a huge audience. It's inevitably going to be a much bigger audience than Moonlight because I guess it's more of a populist crowd pleaser in that way. But I think that this manner of storytelling is also necessary, where we don't try to go you know, 100 miles per hour all the time, or give you all these contrived movie moments. We just sit you in a chair and say, here's what life is like for some people.
Absolutely. And you know, to its credit, I like The Help fine. I think it's a fine piece of entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, and
the performances are good.
It gets the job done. And you know, what's funny is you mentioned how Moonlight is a movie that should be shown in schools. A movie like The Help probably will be shown in high schools for years to come. It's just one of those kinds of movies that maybe that has lands slightly softer blows in terms of, like you said, the tone of the filmmaking and the way in which they tell the story from a director like Tate Taylor, whose tendencies might appeal to mainstream audiences, and more specifically kids. You know, and we'll see if Moonlight passes that test moving forward, because just artistically it's a little more challenging than a movie like The Help. But, you know, at least I was just going to say, at the very least, at least these are topics, this is subject matter that is being broached in a way that they weren't not very long ago.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's an interesting discussion about, like, what our future children will watch in their schools for these history lessons. And, you know, The Help and Loving take place in a particular time during a particular era of American history. And I wonder if Moonlight is going to be viewed as something that shows us about a time that's presently not over with. You know, we had the Prop 8 overturning, but I think gay rights are still very much up in the air right now, and that's a battle that's definitely still being fought. So it's a film that came out in the midst of it rather than something like Loving and Help, which had the advantage of looking back at that time period and saying, like, oh, well, here's what happened at this point and what happened at this point, whereas Moonlight's just trying to show you how things are now.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, not to dwell on The Help, and I don't know if it's been criticized for this reason, but I think in retrospect, people might not necessarily reject it, but dismiss it as a movie that is certainly about the civil rights era and black civil rights and progress that was made way back when, but it's largely seen through the eyes of a white college girl, you know.
That's part of the criticisms, yeah.
Yeah.
And I paid attention to this the second time more because I wasn't sure the first viewing, but the only time we have white characters in Moonlight is the diner scene.
The customers?
Yeah, I think there's two or three white customers, at least one woman with blonde hair, or I'm like, oh, I can safely assume that she's white. But other than that, no one has any sort of speaking roles or any sort of real presence in the film other than black actors.
Definitely. And yeah, so again, this movie's multi-layered too, and I mean, there are even probably definitely comments that it's making, too, about sort of like the American prison system and sort of the experience of black men, you know, in terms of like the characters, Kevin and Chiron, who have each been in prison, you know, like for various reasons.
Yeah.
And Kevin makes the comment, played by Alabama native, as we should mention, Andre Holland at this point, where he mentions, you know, he went to prison for reasons that are, you know, unfortunate and probably unfair. In his case, at least from his point of view. So that's at play here, too, and that's obviously a topic that is a big deal right now. There's a movie out from Ava DuVernay, 13th, on Netflix that speaks to that a little more, much more specifically.
I really need to see that.
Yeah, so a lot going on here in Moonlight, both, again, thematically, politically, for that matter, but also I think when it comes down to it, just in terms of the very simple story that it's telling, that's where the real power of the movie is.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, you mentioned Andre Holland. I think the performances are just so good here that there's not any performance in the film where it felt like it was lacking. You know, you've got a lot of child actors in the first act. And sometimes we have to take that with a grain of salt. But I thought that Chiron, age 8 or 9, was pretty fantastic in terms of how well he, I think, I'm no actor, but I feel like it's harder to hold back when you're acting than it is to just, you know, crank the meter up to 11 and just act your face off. And he's a very subtle quiet presence in that first act. And I think that's a huge challenge for a child actor, and he does great. Chiron at each age is fantastic. I think maybe act two is where it stood out the most to me, that performance, because we see him go through so much. There's the fight in the schoolyard. There's the scene on the beach. We have all those seminal moments. He has a fight with his mother. So I feel like he does the most, there's the most action going on in that second act, where he's asked to do a variety of things, a variety of situations. But yeah, all three across the board, and we can't, you know, leave out Naomi Harris, who's, I think, getting some deserved Oscar buzz for a possible supporting actress nomination. Janelle Monáe, I think this is the first time I'd seen her in anything, and she's great. And so now, looking forward at Hidden Figures, I have no qualms about her being a lead in that. Speaking of Janelle Monáe, I should mention the Jidenna song I brought up earlier. She's kind of she's in tight with Jidenna, and so they're kind of friends. I'm not sure if she's a mentor exactly, but that may have been part of what informed that music selection there. But yeah, and then of course you mentioned Bessemer native Andre Holland, who's been great in everything I've seen him in. I haven't watched the newest American Horror Story. I hear that it's actually pretty good, even though I didn't really love the first several. But The Nick is fantastic. He was really good in 42. There's probably a few others I'm forgetting. Selma, of course. He's great in Selma. So he has a knack for this sort of story. I think that those four things, if you include Moonlight that I just railed off, race relations play a big part in all four of those stories. And so I feel like he's acting with a purpose these days. Like, he's choosing roles that really show what he has, what's important to him, I guess.
Yeah, and he's got a lot of charisma too. I mean, he has a really specific stage or screen presence that and we're going to be seeing a lot more of him. So it's great that he's getting the opportunities, and we as Alabamians are obviously really proud of him. And help me with the actor's name who plays Juan during the first act.
I believe that's the pronunciation is always a little tricky for me, but Mahershala Ali.
Right.
He's
terrific in this.
He's having a really good year too.
Right. And people are probably going to see him in Moonlight. And if they don't know his name, they'll definitely recognize him. I mean, I know that there are plenty of House of Cards fans out there who will recognize him as
Luke Cage now too.
But yeah. Okay. So the guy is active.
Yeah, I'd say he's the biggest star, for sure, in the film. And even though we only see him for the first act,
he makes an enormous impact, you know, like, for sure. Just on us and on the character, especially, like you said. I mean, his presence is enormously felt during the third act in terms of how...
He's the first character that we see.
That's true.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
And a really terrific shot.
He
like I said,
the
opening lante. Of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, again, the biggest star of the show here is Barry Jenkins, let's be honest here, just in terms of the level of filmmaking, the story being told, it all goes through him. And he did a terrific job. And Jeremy, I mean, I think we're winding down here, but anything else you want to get out about Moonlight before we get out of here?
I'll pick your brain about this. How well do you see this doing during award season?
I think it's probably going to be limited to acting nominations, and that might be even limited to one category. You mentioned Naomi Harris. She's somebody who I think is getting enough buzz at the right time of the year, and I think he's even participating in, like, roundtables with different media outlets, including The Hollywood Reporter, which always bodes well if you're making an effort to market the movie and you know, get out there in the awards scene. So I think she's probably your best bet. I mean, I think screenplay is a possibility. I think Best Picture is even a possibility just based on how well this movie's been reviewed. I think the fact that it might not do well in terms of penetrating the mainstream box office, it's not the movie's fault at all. You know, even though I'm glad to see that they made a push to put it in theaters, it reached Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which for a lot of independent movies is rare. So good on them for making that effort and trying to get eyes and create buzz for the movie. So I think that it's possible that it gets nominations. I'm not sure that it's going to win anything at this point because I just don't hear enough people talking about it right now. And if they're not talking about it right now, it may not extend to January. but it's definitely going to show up on end of the year critics lists, and it's going to be a film that people, critics especially, are talking about pretty loudly. So maybe that helps his chances.
Yeah, I, of course, you know, it's mid-November, late November, as we're discussing this, and so many of these Best Picture contenders we haven't seen yet. But there are a few that I think have lost steam that might be leaving the door open, per se. Like Allied comes out this week, and it's getting kind of mediocre reviews. We saw Birth of a Nation, which was, throughout the spring and summer, kind of a favorite coming out of Sundance because of that huge response there. It kind of got sort of mediocre reviews and didn't do well either. And there's that whole controversy with Nate Parker, of course. But I think this is actually going to end up being a pretty strong contender. And I think a big reason is because A24, the studio that produced it and distributed it, they kind of paved the way for themselves being like a force to be reckoned with Room last year, which we saw, you know, Brie Larson won for Room, of course. And so you can give a lot of credit to the film's success to her. But I believe we also saw a screenplay nomination for Room as well as a directing nomination. So, and Best Picture. So I think that, you know, like you said, I'm not sure that anyone in Moonlight got enough screen time to get an acting award. Naomi Harris is probably the biggest favorite there because she's in all three of these segments. But I do think that adapted screenplay is a pretty good bet for at least a nomination. It's based on a play, I guess we should mention, from one of, not a childhood friend per se of Barry Jenkins, but someone that grew up in the same neighborhood as him. So I think that's pretty cool. And then I wouldn't be surprised if Barry got a director nomination or if the whole thing got a Best Picture nomination. And even score, I think the uniqueness of the score, we saw with Birdman a couple of years ago, how the Academy is willing to give out awards for creativity and music particularly. And so I think this is a pretty good contender in that area as well.
I think those are all great points. And you mentioned your point about A24 is great, and you're right. They've shown that they can get behind the movie and make a big awards push, and that can merit Oscar nominations. So, and this could be the movie that they really get behind. And yeah, I could definitely see those things happening. And also, Jeremy, we should definitely mention this just in terms of the Oscar climate last year. What was sort of an elephant in the room really became a controversy. The whole Oscar so white thing that really stole the Oscar experience for a lot of people last year. And that you know, is no reason. You want the movie itself and the performances and all the technical qualities. You want the merit of those things to be what earns those nominations, and you don't want them to just get, you know, basically Oscar nomination handouts. I think that fans of the movie will understand if and when this movie gets nominated in the categories that you mentioned and that it should, that it definitely deserves those things. But, you know, that could unfortunately just be another sort of automatic reason that it's a part of the conversation when it's kind of a difficult conversation to have, because you are going to have those people sort of desperate to in their minds be politically correct and correct the wrongs of the Oscar so white recent history. But this is a movie that belongs in the conversation regardless of any hashtag. I mean, it's a great film. It's a movie that's worthy of all of those different things. It's just, again, it's a factor because of how big a story that became last spring.
Sure. That's a great point that I'm glad you brought up. And I'm going to be blunt here. For anyone that knows me, I'm probably going to be picking on La La Land for the next few months. And don't get me wrong, that could be the greatest movie I've ever seen. I could love it with all my heart. But if we're given Best Picture to a musical about two white people in Los Angeles, when we have things like Moonlight and Loving and Fences and Hidden Figures that are just telling much more relevant and timely stories, even if La La Land's a better film than all of those, I kind of think that we need representation from the Academy to show what's going on in 2016. 100%
agree with you, but Jeremy, we got to see La La Land to know for
we
sure.
We do, and I want
if
to.
If that's how we feel.
Yeah,
you know, just
well,
about that movie specifically. But what we do know yeah. now, what we can say now is that Moonlight belongs in the conversation. It belongs
absolutely.
It belongs in the Oscar conversation moving forward. So it's good to know that.
It would get my vote. I would say right now that it's the best thing I've seen this year. So it would get my vote.
For Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.